Okay, I'm not going to wait for everybody to sit down, but I think we'll start just to get finished in time. And I meant to announce that the closing session will follow. Am I not audible? Okay, I'm quite audible too. You can hear me? Yeah. The closing session will follow straight after this plenary session, so please do not leave for lunch until the final speakers have spoken. So my name is Eva Maria Naug from the LSE, and I'm here to welcome you to the final session of this conference. It is called Higher Education and Development in the Gulf, and we have three speakers here, Dr. Neil Patrick, Dr. Shafiq Kabra, and Jane Kinnamont, and we will start with Neil Patrick, who is a Middle East consultant and is also based at the LSE focusing on the Gulf. Neil is also working with Christian at the LSE Kuwait program. He was, until mid-2009, a professor of political science at the American University of Sharjah. I think that's when we first met as well. He was also a senior analyst at the Economist Intelligence Unit and the head of the Middle East program at the Royal United Services Institute in Whitehall in London. He was also an editor and analyst at the Palestinian Research Center in Jerusalem called Panorama. I'll just move straight on to Neil. 20 minutes.
Right.
And yes.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. And thank you to KFAS for the invitation to speak. I want to talk on the issue of the spheres of education, training, and the labour market, and the extent to which they are joined up or not in the GCC countries. It seems to me a crucial element of human development in the GCC area that there should be a strong interrelationship, not just in theory, but in practice. We also want to bear in mind, though, of course, that it's hard to generalise. The different GCC countries have different ambitions for their nationals. In terms of their policies to address the needs of education and training in the labour market, they put a different balance, a different emphasis on supply and demand side reforms. By that I mean the supply of nationals, as it were, to the jobs market and policies to deal with demand or lack of it for them. But I think together I can generalize that all GCC states are cautious when it comes to aggressively tackling supply-side needs, supply-side reform. There isn't at the moment, although there's much understanding of the need for it, much joining up in practice between these three spheres. So what is the background to that lack of integration, as it were, of the three spheres? And notwithstanding the value of education in and of itself, I think we've been hearing this morning the importance, at least, of ensuring that education provides nationals in the GCC countries with essential life skills, which may indeed be of value to an employer, perhaps assisted through enhanced training programs. First of all, I mean, it's evident that the pressure to create jobs for nationals in the private sector, accepting the limitations of state provision going forward, is much more acute in Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and Oman. Bahrain and Oman are relatively resource poor, particularly Bahrain. Saudi Arabia, of course, appears resource rich, but in contrast to the other Gulf countries, has a massive majority national population, some 18 million. So the need to provide jobs for the increasing number of jobless in Saudi Arabia is particularly acute there. Thinking of Saudi Arabia in particular, this reference here is to the vulnerability that it, together, of course, with its Gulf neighbours, feels when there is a fall in the oil price. And measuring this in terms of real GDP, as opposed to what's happening in the economy affected by the increase in prices, real GDP per head, per capita, for example, in 1998 when the oil price fell, was some 55% down on 1981, which is really quite staggering. Put a different way, 2009, the year for which we have the most recent data, GDP per capita in Saudi Arabia was 40% down on 30 years earlier. This is real GDP. Or measuring a decade average. For the 2000s, real GDP per head some 20% down on the 1980s. So you have a sense of the acuteness of the problem, particularly in Saudi Arabia. The smaller national populations, of course, of energy-rich Gulf states, and here I'm thinking obviously about Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, and Kuwait, do feel less troubled, and their policies, to some extent, reflect that by the pressure to have jobs for their nationals in the private sector. But they all share a need to do this. We're aware, obviously, of the demographic pressures behind the need to find jobs in the private sector, some 40% of nationals under the age of 15. Youth unemployment estimated variously in real terms to be at least a third, possibly approaching 40% in, as I say, these more vulnerable countries, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and Oman. And in terms of the expectations of that growing youth bulge, a more educated, despite criticisms of the education systems in these countries, in general a much more educated populace with greatly increased material expectations, but at the same time, less material props in terms of what the state is able to provide going forward. Unless we forget, and we've seen this obviously in the Maghreb and Egypt, but also now in Bahrain and Oman, political frustrations being at least partly caused by joblessness. And when it comes to middle-class frustrations, economically related political concerns, whether it's the notion of the inefficiency of the state, the unpredictability of the state, or indeed the corruption of state officials. So tackling the job needs and finding policies to address them is already arguably a political problem and one therefore related to security. When he was Crown Prince, Abdullah of Saudi Arabia said, in effect, the party is over. The oil boom is over, he said in 98. He said that at a time, of course, of the collapse of oil prices, but he was intending to address the issue that we cannot continue to hope for an increase in energy prices in order to meet short-term needs within the state sector. He recognized that private sector jobs are needed, not short-term palliatives. Of course, it's quite an irony that with the large spending commitment upon his return to the kingdom just a few weeks ago, amongst those big-ticket items was 10,000 immediate jobs in the Ministry of Interior, reflecting, of course, a concern about possible political discontent feeding into a security problem and therefore a chance to mop up a degree of unemployment rather than perhaps thinking in a more constructive, longer-term sense. And indeed, Prince Nayef, for his part, in the early 2000s, was saying that the unemployed are our greatest security risk. Now, he was particularly thinking at the time about the threat from al-Qaeda and the idea of Islamic militancy being exploited in terms of unemployed individuals who might be shifted towards extreme acts of violence. But it seems to me the security concern, whether we're talking about those who may wish to have a more pluralist political system, which seems to be the more focused concern of protesters on some of the streets of Arab capitals, or whether we're talking about radicalism, we have an economic element at base which is recognized by Gulf leaders, but what are the policies to actually address them? So what are people being educated for at present in the different GCC countries? One Emirati former education minister said to me that when we want to emiratize our workforce, we're thinking of senior management. Again, so the less acute pressures in the UAE in terms of the real GDP per capita situation, for example, means, and also to some extent a cultural conception, means that he's thinking about emiratizing just, if you like, the super elite jobs. And maybe Dubai Ports is perhaps a good example of that. They're claiming 100% emiratization at the most senior level and something like 80% emiratization at the level of lower management, as it were. In Oman, right next door, a very different conception where they've banned foreigners from driving taxis. They see Omanization as working much lower down the hierarchy, as it were. So different nationalization conceptions, different economic realities between the Gulf states, but a common feature, of course, being the rentier economy and the rentier state and the politics of that, which of course makes it difficult to take up the policies that shift from the short-term palliatives that Crown Prince Abdullah talked about to the longer-term needs. When there's diversification being encouraged, of course, also moving away from those sectors that appear to have a relationship with hydrocarbons, such as, for example, petrochemical development in terms of subsidized feedstock, the kind of diversification, for example, in Dubai and the post-oil economy, which we've heard about today, in terms of development of the real estate sector, development of tourism. In many senses, of course, you never get away from hydrocarbons because the investment for these potentials, initially at least, was related to oil wealth indirectly. But what is the conception of the position of the nationals in these diversified industries that are, in a sense, still fitting within a rentier mentality? We have, I think, in broad terms across the GCC, although I hesitate to, as I say, to generalize, an underdeveloped, energy-reliant industrial base. So when we're thinking about jobs in the private sector, there's a difficulty of thinking about the kind of industries that can actually provide sustainable employment for those nationals. Very often it's thinking about more rent-accruing activity, perhaps indeed in economic zones where there may be very little take-up of employment for nationals, but an income accruing to the local state. And very often involving in the service sector a large pool of non-nationals. When there are policies to nationalise labour, there is a problem of it being to some extent superficial, providing local faces in very public situations to satisfy national identity concerns. This policy in terms of fixed quotas across a broad range of different sectors throughout the GCC countries for employment is obviously very much resented. Very often they see it as a tax as opposed to a means to add local value and local knowledge. Recruitment will tick boxes and not be strategically planned. We have the phenomenon well documented, including by one body in Dubai, for example, a government body, the Knowledge and Human Development Association, of ghost workers, workers who are paid, in effect, not to turn up, and ghost companies that try and get around the limits of the quota policy of fixing the number of foreign nationals by setting themselves up in an agent or part of a wider company and then shifting the foreign labour that's supposed to be contained there into other parts of the company's activity. So it's ticking boxes, it's not actually providing significant or thought-through solutions. We often hear, sadly, that nationals, not all nationals, but the nationals who are seeking jobs, for example, in the private sector, or being encouraged to at least think about it, are not equipped for the kind of work that's wanted by foreign or local private companies in those countries. A common complaint was put to me by a Kuwaiti businessman, as it happens, was that nationals very often will not take entry-level positions, and we heard this reference earlier on today, and that they are liable to job hop from one company to another, depending upon fairly short-term sense of expectations and what that job should perhaps provide them. We are hearing, though, talk about reforming education provision at the most junior level up to the tertiary level to try and reform the situation in terms of ensuring that nationals have greater skills to meet the demands of the private sector, but perhaps almost in direct contradiction at the same time to uphold national identity. I mean, if you have a private sector that has more nationals in it contributing constructively, then that seems to me useful in terms of national identity. But if at the same time your education reform involves a great deal of emphasis on the English language, very often as a language of instruction by Western teachers, particularly at the higher education level, then there's a disconnect, it seems to me, between the reform and the national identity ambition. And as I said earlier, in many senses, what comes out of this? Is it about creating nationals who are really market-friendly in terms of the jobs market, or is it really thinking more about service sector expansion, in other words, education zones that provide platforms for profit-making universities, rather than necessarily ensuring that nationals are equipped for the world of work? Now, the Guttaries have attempted to try and marry together a market-orientated education reform with the advice of the Rand Corporation, and used vouchers, something that was a no-no for Margaret Thatcher in Britain in the 1980s, where people can buy education, public education provision, as part of a wider reform of public education reform, which includes a major emphasis on the English language and on more practical-based skill sets and knowledge. The Omanis are more cautious. Their so-called basic schools are bilingual. They're not, in a sense, abandoning the Arabic language, and they put some emphasis on vocational skills at a relatively early level. The Emiratis, just picking up some examples, toyed with the idea of English language schools at the secondary level, or the grades from 6 and 7 onwards through to 12, abandoned them because of local pressures in terms of national identity, and have shifted now to so-called new model schools where they combine English and Arabic instruction. At the higher education end, what is happening? The traditional universities, in terms of the public providers or the state-related providers in the UAE, offer what one analyst described to me as chalk and talk. It's the top-down rote learning method that would be familiar very often in the schooling system continued at the university. Arguably, this encourages what is also a problem of a brain drain of highly intelligent Saudi or Emirati or Guttari or whatever nationals leaving the region and seeking their education in the West rather than enhancing their commitment and involvement, not only in local education, but possibly in local economic life later. We know also that in the higher education sector, in the tertiary education sector, there's not enough upskilling, as it were, horrible word, skill improvement to meet the needs of local companies, whether it's foreign workers, the children, as it were, of long-term residents, or whether it's nationals entering the job market. A common complaint is that higher education is disconnected from the business sector. Now, the Guttari approach in its education city is, of course, to try and meet national aspirations. One figure I was told by one of the foreign universities there was to try and have 40% Guttari attendance across the range of its courses, but doing it by, in a sense, providing a service revenue income and at the same time combining it with a science park so that the research being conducted there will hopefully feed into local economic development. I think there has to be a question mark about whether that is a plausible strategy. We're seeing a similar idea, in a sense, at KAUST near Jeddah, the King Abdullah University of Science and Technology. The realistic figure there, I'm told, is actually something like 8% attendance by Saudis. But the idea seems to be not just about educating Saudis, but creating an R&D hub, as it were, that will feed into wider Saudi economic development. The question mark, I think, is whether it is, to use that cliche, an island of excellence that's being created, a bit like Aramco itself and SABIC, or whether it actually relates to that wider economy, whether the kind of linkages that Christian was talking about earlier, working at the horizontal level as well as the vertical level, are actually being applied, or whether it's simply an island of excellence. In Dubai, the free zones that we've seen, and Chris commented on these earlier on, have not arguably, in terms of the knowledge village, for example, had any relationship to wider national realities. Indeed, one of the problems argued about free zones is that very often the terms are made so attractive, whether we're talking about education or other spheres, that the wider national needs are arguably not being addressed at all. The place of women within this assessment is problematic. Zayed University and American University of Sharjah have done well Zaid University spent a number of years being segregated, but arguably was good at ensuring the full range of subjects were available. AUS is a co-educational establishment. That can't be said for all universities in terms of ensuring full access to the range of options. There's a gender gap clearly between the number of women who are graduating and those who are present in the workforce. And there's a pressure in terms of local reaction as to whether it's suitable for them to be in the workforce, and yet they're increasingly big economic players in terms of family income in Saudi Arabia. In terms of vocational training, and I'm going to make this quick because I recognize the time pressure, there is an issue about whether the wider needs of those nationals is actually being met, sometimes by unregulated providers, and whether the training that's being provided is properly reflected on and followed up as a consequence of proper analysis. I'm going to skip very quickly because we're aware, I think, a number of us, of the attempts that are being made. The Bahrainis and the Omanis arguably being the most advanced to try and meet both the output improvement of the national entering the workforce and incentivizing their employment. In the Omanis, they're trying to focus on sectors that the nationals are likely to actually enter. And this is also arguably about a need, in my view, to think about not simple quotas, but incentivizing the employment of nationals. Not forcing people to take on nationals, but incentivizing their employment in areas that they are likely to access. The Omanis are starting to do this, and the Bahrainis are giving it some thought. The companies themselves will often say that taxes, in effect, not to employ nationals, but taxes on, for example, the employment of foreigners to make it less attractive, doesn't fit their interests. In Bahrain, there is a tax which feeds retraining efforts, but it was much lower than the Bahraini government wanted because of the complaints of Bahraini business. So governments have got to try and override those pressures and look to the longer-term interests of businesses themselves. There may need to be coordination between education, training, and jobs in one body, something talked about in the UAE for more than 10 years but not achieved. Teaching, a crucial issue here. How much is teaching seen as an appropriate vocation for nationals? A status issue and pay is part of this problem. So if we can introduce proper training and acceptability for nationals entering the teaching profession and higher education in terms of lecturing, this seems to be an important part of the reform of education, just as the method of teaching and the content of that teaching as well. Tax foreign jobs, or specific sectors, I would argue, don't employ companies to simply hire nationals regardless of their ability. But a crucial part of this focused taxation policy and incentivizing of work in the private sector is data. If there isn't adequate data collection, if there isn't detailed knowledge of what's happening in different sectors, then, of course, there's a problem about achieving this. End the sponsorship system. The Omanis have done so. The Bahrainis have claimed that they've done so, but it appears to be more sector-specific, and at present, it seems to be the case across the GCC that you need an initial sponsor, even if you can then swap jobs without a sponsor. In other words, making it easier for foreign nationals to transfer jobs, to be the ones to job hop, makes them less attractive over the nationals. And it also, of course, plays a part in improving perhaps the human rights image of the sponsorship scheme. Incentivize national workers. Some of this goes on already, but there could be a more advanced policy based on heavier taxation of foreigners in the sectors where nationals are liable and able to enter. And also, in an upturn period, think about disincentivizing employment in the public sector. So there's a political need to address this problem, to address the issue of preparing for the world of work, of moving from the former notion of the social contract based on comfortable public sector provision to incentivizing private sector provision. There are political constraints at doing this that affect states and affect GCC cooperation, but ultimately grand projects, islands of excellence, will not actually tackle the more substantive longer-term needs unless there's a joined-up strategy from education, training, and the labour market. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Dr. Shafiq Ghabra on public universities in the Gulf, challenges and possibilities. Dr. Kabra is Professor of Political Science at Kuwait University and was the founding president of the American University of Kuwait from 2003 to 2006. He's also the founder and president of Jasur Arabia Leadership and Consultancy Center and directed the Center of Strategic and Future Studies at Kuwait University from 2002 to 2003. Prior to that, he was the director of the Kuwait Information Office in Washington, D.C., and he was also the editor-in-chief of the Journal of the Social Sciences at Kuwait University. He's probably quite well known here as the producer and anchor of a weekly talk show on Kuwait TV, the weekly Divania.
Stop 2006.
Yes.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Then my focus is private education, higher private education, talking about colleges, universities in the Gulf. And since most of those universities tend to be English-based, that is, the language used is English instruction, many are American, and there are few that are of other origins, whether have a British connection or have a European connection or a French connection. So I'll try to give you an overview of the state of private education at the level of colleges and universities in the Gulf, maybe in the region as well. There are so many similarities. One issue that comes to mind, to what extent are the universities of the quality and the standard? To what extent do they really represent a model that does produce the impact, the needed quality for the market and for society and for development? There are four models of such universities. You're looking up there, you will have nothing to look at besides yourself. And so there are four models, basically, that, but it's nice to look at yourself. There are four models. The oldest model is the American University of Beirut, the American University of Cairo. I would also say the Lebanese American University. These are just non-profit, independent, American-type education, and they tend to be of a certain caliber, with a certain history. Still, they face challenges, like everybody would face challenges, political instability, recruitment, governance, there's so many issues, but yet they continue to be of a certain quality and represent a model on its own. They're accredited by American accreditation agencies. I would say that the American University of Sharjah, though government-owned and non-profit, is becoming closer in terms of its ability to provide a certain quality of education to these three. So I will add that in a way, but it's government-owned, while the others have a board. They're owned by nobody. They're basically non-profit institutions of higher education. The second model are branches of Western universities and colleges. There's so many, but the one to look at today is the Qatar Foundation and the group of universities, such as Carnegie Mellon, Georgetown, Cornell, etc. And that represents a model. These are branches. Are they of the same quality of the original university? Somewhat, but not necessarily. Do they face challenges? Definitely they do. To be part of a culture that they are operating in, and what standard to maintain, and at what level. Yet it represents a model that is emerging in the region of full-fledged satellite campus branch of a mother or father university in existence in the West or in the US or in the UK, etc. This is another then model. And the third model is local institutions. They are local, but with an international connection. They are local private universities with an international connection. And this is the biggest group of them. They can have many different names. Gust University in Kuwait, American University of Kuwait, so many others in Bahrain, in Oman, in the region. It is a local university with a local capital, privately owned, not government owned. While the Qatar Foundation is government owned, this is privately owned in this model, and seeking an American education or a British-based education or a French-based education, depending on the university they are connected to. This is a third model. This is the largest one. This is the biggest one now. This is where you see a lot of expansion as well, and it stands with also certain challenges. All of these universities, take away the American University, the LAU, and the first model, are relatively new. We're talking about the last 10, 15 years. So this is a new phenomenon in the region. It will go through phases, maybe phases of weak education, and maybe then phases of improved education. They'll go through phases. There's a lot of learning to see in this overall development. And the fourth model is actually, the fourth model, and I just wanted to mention it to you, is that you have institutions that are government-owned, and they operate on, originally they've had Arabic education, and they shifted to English, but they're still government-owned. So they don't fit our exact model, but I wanted you to be aware of it. But also, the government-owned that have the practices of a Western curriculum, and there are several in that direction. So private universities in the region are going through then growth, many challenges as well. But what are some of the challenges? So, they definitely teach, they definitely produce, they definitely have students who graduate. There is an output, and there is and they provide an important way of connecting people to a world that is changing around us. The kind of curriculum, the kind of education, the kind of textbooks, the kind of teachers. But yet there are challenges. So I would like to focus on challenges in order for us to see what we can do for the next era and the next phase. One of the challenges is, to what extent are the universities student-centered? There is a whole philosophy of student-centeredness. To what extent are they really student-centered? The student is the core. The interest of the student is the core. The level of knowledge for the student is the core. And that means that the room that you prepare has to be of a certain level and quality, that the ratio of professors and teachers to students have to be of a certain number, not more, that the quality of the faculty has to be of a certain quality, that the attentiveness, that you have to be very attentive to student needs in order to be able to learn and to think and to evolve. You have to be responsive. You have to listen, and there has to be that dynamic relationship with the students at large. I have major questions to what extent any of our institutions is seriously student-centered. It could be centered around leaders. It could be centered around owners. It could be centered around profit makers. It could be centered around sometimes faculty. It could be centered around a lot of things. But sometimes what I see, the least of our concern, is student-centeredness. And that's a major challenge. And today, with the atmosphere in the Arab world, we have an Arab world that is centered around leaders, not people. To what extent would this revolution affect us and affect our students? It is a way of thinking. And I see in that a major challenge to all the private institutions of education in the Gulf, but I would add, in the Arab world as well. To what extent are we aware of the level and the impact and the importance of liberal arts in our education? Meaning here critical thinking, meaning here ability to become a long life learner, writing skills, thinking skills, reading skills. To what extent is the purpose of education over a period of 4 years in college really the aim in the end is to produce a certain human being that is less prejudiced towards others, more open towards people and society, more understanding of different viewpoints, good writing skills, thinking skills, ability to learn on your own, as learning is a lifelong commitment. Things like that are not that emphasized, not that serious in our educational overall programs. And therefore, there is so many issues then, because if you are student-centered and if you are committed to critical thinking and lifelong learning and producing better results for reading and writing and comprehension and understanding, you really need faculty that have a high morale. You can't build an institution where faculty have very low morale. Because it's like saying, well, I'm building a hospital and I have the best doctors, but they are of very bad, very low morale. And I am expected to treat so many patients and produce good results. Doesn't work. Faculty are the core of the learning process. And overloading them with so many courses, overloading them with so many responsibilities, and not listening to them or to their needs or to their issues, making decisions over their heads without respect to their points of view, the lack of that dialogue will produce not only low morale, the good faculty. The good faculty will easily leave and go elsewhere where they are better respected. After all, we are in an open market and we move freely from one place to another. This is not serfdom anymore. We are in an open market and people move freely, and therefore faculty has to be treated in a certain way, and that brings us to the entire issue of faculty governance in these institutions and the way decisions are made. And in many Western institutions, we see how faculty's role has become bigger and bigger, how tenure has played a certain role, how other factors made these institutions places where faculty can teach with a sense of dignity and a sense of high morale, and where they can do research and where they develop and evolve. And that reflects on better teaching and brings better results. And what I see in many of the universities, there is no clue of what this means altogether. And in the private universities, absolutely no clue. And if there is one, it's totally ignored. And you end up with a lot of attrition, faculty attrition, and difficulty in recruitment. Very high difficulty in recruiting quality faculty. So you end up with third level and fourth level and fifth level and sixth level, and I don't know what else, where you'll end up with. You go down. You don't go up this way. Education is very expensive. And that's an issue here. So one has to keep that in mind. But since we're talking about faculty and faculty morale, you have to relate. You have to see the relationship between faculty, the way they think, the way they are, the way they learn, and the way they've gained their PhDs in very different and important and various institutions in the world, and the whole issue of freedom of academic freedoms, freedom of expression, academic freedoms. Academic freedoms are important and core. And it is in 5 more minutes, and that's great. Thank you. And it is very, very important to realize that without academic freedoms, we are also impacting student-centeredness. We are also impacting the levels of education. And I'll give you examples. Let's say you need to teach comparative religion. Well, I've taken comparative religion in Georgetown University when I was 18 years old. I had no problem with it. And I've taken Buddhism and Hinduism. I've taken all kinds of courses. You learn. It doesn't mean you don't become, you're not a Muslim anymore. Come teach this in our part of the world, and it raises all kinds of issues. I'll give you another example. A faculty will come, and they have an excellent textbook, a first-class textbook. But there is an article for Salman Rushdie. Oh, Salman Rushdie. So what do you do? Do you approve the textbook? Or you say, you know, don't bring this textbook, let's play it safe. But it's a good textbook for our kids. Many universities will say, no, 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 let's play it safe. No need for this. So what are you doing? What are you teaching the students? Censorship. I'll give you another example from art. I mean, there is a big problem teaching art. You know, art has all this creativity, but also you draw people, you draw human beings. There are all kinds of figures and all kinds of shapes, and all kinds of books of art are very open when they express the human body and the human physical expression. You can't have these books in. So what do they learn in art? I mean, they have to go to Italy to learn art then. Why are we doing it here? The Italians will teach us. You see, these are serious issues, and I can say of many. I mean, it can get to politics and religion. It can get to culture and history. It can get to different interpretations of history that allows you to learn all the dynamics, which we have learned when we went to Western universities. There were all these points of views. It doesn't mean I don't become an Arab anymore. I learn. I hear all kinds of views. The Zionist and the non-Zionist, the Israeli and the Arab and the Muslim, and you get and you make your own conclusion. You are the one to make the conclusion. The faculty has to provide you with various views that allows you to learn, so you appreciate, so you're even able to counter and to discuss with others. So that is an issue. I will also discuss quickly, the issue of universities for profit and universities for not for profit. That's a big challenge. And I'm not sure many of the private universities that we see now in the Gulf are for profit. And I didn't hear yet of a university that is for profit that has become a first-class university in the world. So that's a challenge. We have to make... Now, you tell me, but you've invested and you want to return. There has to be some sort of a model that allows a certain return that is fixed, that is long-term. However, much of the income has to go back to the university in order to bring new computers and to improve the facility and to recruit good faculty and to keep the old faculty and to create a good and a real, serious, comprehensive university life. That issue has not yet been settled. In Turkey, they have settled it. Universities must be owned by foundations and only by foundations, so they do not become for profit. In our part of the world, it's not the case. And that has created so many issues and problems in governance and in the entire situation in the university. So I see your body language, 1 minute. Let me then conclude by saying, we are at the crossroads. We need quality education. We still don't have it. We still don't have it. We're still searching. We have something. I'm not an absolutist. I mean, we have something. But is it at the level of A or B or C or D? Is it between C and D? How can we improve it and make it at a higher and a better level is still a major question, is still a major challenge. And with the atmosphere in the Arab world, with the changes I see existing today, rebellion or reform, and the combination of both, we really have to do a lot in order to deal with this subject at the level that is needed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Gabra. It was very informative and much grounds for collaboration, with Western institutions increasingly failing its students in the area of critical thinking. And we practice the art of self-censorship. So, I'd like to move on to our final speaker, Jane Kinnamond. She's going to be discussing education for diversification, are policymakers solving the right problems? Jane's Associate Director for Middle East and Africa at the Economist Intelligence Unit, and she directs the Economist Middle East Corporate Network as well, a briefing service for senior executives covering the Middle East. She has written extensively for The Economist, The Guardian, Los Angeles Times, The South China Morning Post, Middle East Policy, Middle East International, and Gulf News. And Jane's also won a cutting-edge award from the Next Century's Foundation International Media Council in 2006, and for her coverage of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. We look forward to your talk, Jane.
Thank you very much. Just to update you guys, I think you have a slightly old biography. I'm now working for Chatham House, doing
Chatham
kind of policy-focused
well.
Research, which is a think tank in London. But I just joined there 5 weeks ago. Before that, I was working for several years for the Economist Intelligence Unit, and my remarks are mainly going to be drawn from work I did for them, and particularly a series of papers that we did about the economic challenges facing the GCC in the years to 2020. I can give you the link to download those papers for free afterwards if you're interested in hearing more. The stuff that I prepared basically comes in two parts. The first is looking at diversification and asking basically what is diversification for. The second is looking at education reforms, how they're linked to diversification or how maybe they're not linked enough. I think the other speakers did cover some of the challenges and priorities for education in a lot of detail, so probably I'll spend more of the limited time talking about diversification and what is it for. We had some discussion of this already here yesterday, and somebody was asking, you know, if you look at the more diversified economies in the GCC, such as Bahrain and Oman, can we say that those are really the highest growing economies? Well, definitely we can't. Diversification is not really intended to produce the highest level of growth. There are basically three main reasons why countries in the Gulf, all of them, aim to diversify their economies away from the current reliance on oil and gas. The first is to reduce the economic volatility that comes from depending on a single commodity export when the prices are largely determined by forces beyond your control in the international market. The Gulf states have a lot of experience with this volatility when oil prices have collapsed in the past. Also, of course, Kuwait and Bahrain experienced a precursor to this in 1929 and the early 1930s when the international price of pearls collapsed as Japan invented the cultured pearl. So it's really about reducing volatility. Number two, the incentive is to prepare for a post-oil age. Now, Neil, I think, importantly mentioned that there are huge differences between the Gulf countries, and some of the GCC states will have to face that post-oil age a lot earlier than others. So it's really little surprise that Oman and Bahrain, which have the most limited oil production and which see their oil production falling, have been the countries that diversified earliest, fastest, and perhaps most successfully so far. There is a risk of complacency, of course, in other countries where oil reserves are due to last a lot longer. And there is a question to be asked about when that post-oil age is to come. If it's seen as coming in 80 years or 100 years, it is harder for governments to motivate themselves now. But, of course, there is always that ever-present risk that there could be a technological change and that the world's dependence on oil could end before, you know, the oil actually runs out. I think the recent tragic events in Japan have probably increased some of the complacency in this region about the reliance on oil. But it shouldn't make diversification less of a priority. Thirdly, the third main policy goal for GCC governments when they're trying to diversify the economy is to create jobs for nationals, something we've heard a lot about. It's a big priority, again, in different countries for different reasons. Oil and gas aren't labour-intensive industries. They're not big employers. There is a need to develop non-oil and gas industries in order to create those jobs. So all those aims sound good. They're all desirable. It's pretty hard to disagree with any of them. But I think something that is sometimes a little bit overlooked in this debate about diversification and how admirable it is that there are trade-offs between these goals. And in particular, there is a trade-off between, do you identify the sectors where you have the greatest competitive advantage compared to other countries, or do you prioritise the sectors that are going to provide the most jobs for Gulf nationals, not for foreign workers? And I think that's a tension that every country will address differently. I'm not sure that it's being sort of explicitly discussed and debated enough. There is also, within that job creation debate, an issue over whether you should prioritise the quantity of jobs for nationals or the quality. To generalise, Saudi, Oman and Bahrain probably have more of an issue with quantity. In those countries, nationals are generally willing to take a broader range of jobs in the private sector, such as taxi drivers or maybe working in tourism. Whereas in Kuwait, UAE and Qatar, where the welfare states are a lot stronger and the ratio of the oil production to the population is a lot higher, nationals have less need to work. So the job creation becomes a different dilemma, more about how governments can generate attractive careers that meet the aspirations of this new generation in the Gulf, a generation which has grown up with levels of wealth that are probably unprecedented in the world, and therefore also very high expectations. But if we look at the areas where the GCC has a comparative advantage, you know, if we look at the areas where foreign investors tend to concentrate on their investment, and if you interview and discuss with foreign investors and multinational companies, they basically cluster the GCC's really competitive sectors into three main areas. And I will note that none of those areas at the moment is really something that we could call a knowledge economy or a high-tech area. The first one is the energy-intensive industries, and that would range from pure oil refining into petrochemicals, plastic, metals, aluminium, where there's been a huge amount of investment and there will be yet more investment over the next 10 years, steel, etc. And those are, you know, basically have an advantage because of the low cost of energy feedstock. The availability of gas has been a problem for those industries in recent years, but definitely going forwards, you know, that is one area of continued competitive advantage, despite some of the important concerns that Justin raised yesterday about the increasing cost of producing the gas here. The second broad area of perceived competitive advantage for the Gulf would be in the area of trade, logistics, ports and so on, which is largely based on the location. It's also based on traditions here in the Gulf and on policy decisions to make trade affordable, to have very low customs barriers, access to free trade zones, etc. And that's somewhere, again, where you do see Gulf companies acting as outward investors, where for the most part, you know, as was highlighted by some of the discussion over sovereign wealth funds, when the Gulf's investing overseas, it's investing capital, ports is interesting because you do see, for instance, Dubai Ports World setting up ports overseas, for instance, in Africa, and actually exporting expertise to the rest of the world, which is a bit different from the overall sort of perception of the Gulf. The third area where the Gulf is strong and competitive globally would be in, I'd cluster these all together, sort of tourism, aviation, leisure and retail. And again, a lot of that has to do with the location and the climate. The location is definitely very promising for the future. It's been an interesting, clear trend in the tourism into Dubai that a lot of the growth recently has come from the growing middle classes in India and China. The Chinese in particular, as you know, tend to shop very heavily in Dubai because the tax differences make it worthwhile to do so. And of course, the Gulf countries have developed a lot of infrastructure, and Saudi Arabia has the unusual advantage of being home to the holy site, which basically guarantee it a lot of demand for religious tourism pretty much forever. The other kind of competitive advantages of the Gulf would be the low tax. Again, that's a function of the oil wealth, and there's a question about how long all the states will be able to sustain that, probably particularly the Emirate of Dubai, maybe some questions about Bahrain and Oman also, and the abundance of foreign labour. Financial services has been emerging regionally as well, and in the case of Islamic finance, that is another area where you could see the Gulf exporting expertise, but it's still a very small part of the global financial services industry. And there's a debate generally, which we've certainly been having a lot in the UK, about the extent to which financial services should be viewed as a sector, a productive sector generating employment in its own right, or whether it should really be about financial intermediation. But although the financial services picture is in some ways pretty impressive, you know, it is overall still the case that the GCC runs a deficit when it comes to services, which is paid for by the large trade surplus owing to oil. So these are really the main sectors where the GCC is internationally seen as having a competitive advantage. That's not to say there are not other high growth sectors. Of course, power, water, health, education, sectors that are underpinned by public spending and by population growth are important. And there may be potential to develop education, tourism, health tourism, etc. But they're not hugely competitive by global standards. Then when you look at the knowledge economy, I mean, the knowledge economy is very, very appealing as a way of developing sectors that really present attractive career opportunities for nationals. But the knowledge economy isn't yet an area where the GCC is seen as having a competitive advantage. The factors were discussed earlier, particularly the low research and development spending by international standards, but also other issues such as the shortage of linkages between academia and business and government and so on. We heard about those earlier. Certainly a lot of money is now being invested in developing those sectors. But I think a word of warning that I would add is this is going to be a massively competitive space. When people are thinking of the knowledge economy at the moment, they do tend to think about competing with Silicon Valley, established Western centres. You know, Israel was mentioned. But basically every country in the world now wants to develop a knowledge economy. One of the big challenges there is going to be India. GE of the US, which has always been a US-based company and is one of the largest companies in the world, they've recently, I think last year, opened a research and development facility in India where they're employing 5,500 Indian scientists. So they see the quality as being there. They think the Indian scientists will be very good at innovating and developing technologies that are appropriate to poorer emerging Asian markets, which are the growing markets. So this is going to be an extremely competitive space, and I think there is a big question around how the Gulf is really going to be competitive in that area. Certainly there is a lot of money being spent, which is definitely a good way to attract investment and provide incentives for investment. But it doesn't seem so far that the right economic incentives are really in place to motivate nationals to focus on education, thinking, production of knowledge, and so on. There's been some very interesting work done at the Dubai Economic Council based on UAE labour force surveys, and similar work done in Qatar, which is basically showing that rewards in the workplace are not really linked to one's educational achievements. More than anything else, they are linked to one's nationality. But even within looking at the Emirati nationals, the curve is not very steep. The returns economically on acquiring a PhD are pretty low. Now, of course, those aren't the only reasons to acquire a PhD. I mean, I've seen research that suggests that in the West, having a postgraduate degree in social science actually decreases your earnings potential. But I think that's because what people who do those often tend to choose jobs for reasons other than remuneration. But I think when we are having an economic debate about this, we do need to address some of those economic incentives. And this is where there can be a little bit of a clash between sort of Western-style free market economics that you might go off and learn in business school and some of the issues around the rentier state. So I did think it was very interesting to hear that there's perhaps not enough teaching in this region of the specificities of the Gulf's own economies, because I think if you don't analyse these as part of your economic assessment, you simply won't get the right solution. I attended a very interesting conference in Dubai at the end of last year, where a presenter from the Dubai Economic Council, who was an expatriate like myself, presented these findings and made the arguments about the need for incentives for studying. And there was a very interesting response by an economist from the Gulf who was saying, but everyone's employed in the public sector and employment isn't for rewarding productivity. This is a neocolonialist Western idea. You know, it's really about sharing the wealth of the country, which is good. So there is a bit of a clash of systems there, which probably needs to be thought about and addressed more. I did also just want to sort of comment on some of those issues around critical thinking. I do think that is a big issue. That is perhaps slightly a Western perspective. I think it's interesting that Singapore is seen as a model by some Gulf states, because that is a country where they don't really have political freedom, but they have a well-developed education system. And I suspect that both of those attributes are quite attractive for the Gulf. There are certainly unintended consequences of education. I mean, it is notable that the Tunisians are one of the most educated people in North Africa. But of course, there was a huge mismatch between their educational qualifications and the jobs that were available to them. I was also attending a recent conference in Beirut about unemployment in the Arab world, and some people were saying, we don't use our graduates, we don't get returns on education. And one lady said, these revolutions are our returns on education, which I found interesting, so I'm stealing her line. But if one was a very traditional, conservative, authoritarian ruler, one might take the Tunisian experience as a lesson that it's not a good idea to educate people too much. And, you know, it sounds funny, but I think there are quite real concerns about what exactly happens when, to what extent you can teach people to really question authority, question the teacher, question the parent, etc. What are the political implications of that? I'd note, probably just in passing, Bahrain, which has been a leader in the field of education reform, has very recently suspended a number of scholarships for overseas students because they took part in political protests. I think another particularly interesting aspect as well is, as was mentioned by Neil, and so I won't dwell on it and I'm running out of time, but the increasing education of women, which is not being matched by opportunities for women in the labour force. I think that is also going to lead to some quite interesting political and social tensions, perhaps particularly in Saudi Arabia, where the female students are very much outnumbering the male students, and while I don't wish to be sexist, the statistics do show that they are getting better degrees. I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jenny. We've got until a quarter past for questions for about a bit more than 25 minutes, and I'll start taking them in clusters of three. Alexis and...
Thank you. Alexander Nias from Georgetown. I would like to thank the speakers. And I want to comment on the second speaker. You laid out some of the measures where we can basically measure the success of the different models of education, which is whether they focus on the student, the quality and the morale of the faculty, and so on. And I will start from the example you gave about being at Georgetown 18 years ago and being able to take religion without destroying your life. Well, 18 years after, you can just go to Qatar and still get a degree from Georgetown and still take a religion class. Actually, you are required to take the same class that you take on main campus. So I think that shows a lot of achievement by the Gulf countries over the past few years. There are still a lot of struggles, but there have been some achievements. And to make the whole discussion you had more productive, it would be good to look at the differences within the different models on the different measures you said, because maybe some of those models are driven by as a response to the failures of the previous models. It would be nice to look at the interactions between them and the spillovers. And I think there's a fifth model, by the way, which is NYU Abu Dhabi. But thank you.
I'm Iqbal Zaidi, former diplomat. My question, or rather a suggestion, is for Dr. Shafiq. He has been talking about different universities, and in Kuwait they have so many private universities, but I wonder, there is no engineering university at this time when, you know, when we are in a scientific world, we should have more engineering and scientific universities. There are far too many universities, including Kuwait University, offering subjects in humanities and arts.
So I just wanted to make a brief comment, because there was this sort of, there was a theme running through for the entire sessions about critical thinking and liberal arts education. And two comments on that. First of all, there are different university models around, so we always think about the US-UK education, but really here we have to focus on the top 10, top 15 universities and what sort of skill set they can actually give their graduates. And then the Gulf really has to think very hard what it is that they're looking for in a university education. I found it's very Eurocentric, or Western-centric, to belittle Asia to say, well, they can't do critical thinking. As it happens, my uncle is Nandanilekani from Infosys, and he would get really irritated if you think India can't do critical thinking. They have a lot of successful companies there, both in India, in China, and in Singapore. And it's really a Western view of us to think, well, because I studied history or politics, we're kind of superior in our way of analyzing things. I don't agree with that at all, by the way.
Thanks. I think we'll take the three questions first and then move on to the next round of threes.
But can you just wait? I had a question. What is it that you don't agree with at all? If you can state
yes.
that.
I don't, for example, what is it that the Gulf's looking for? Are you looking for engineers? Are you looking for economists? Are you looking for sort of liberal arts graduates who, most of which, to be fair about the UK, if you want to have a career with a liberal arts degree, you would have to go to one of the top five, top 10 universities. The City of London will not take you if you haven't been to Oxbridge, LSE, Imperial, Durham, you know. And so this is not being said, but if you study certain subjects at other universities that are not in the top 10, you will not get a good job, all right? Because, and the question is, how do you assess critical thinking? Is an essay written by a Cambridge graduate directly better than an essay written by someone who worked at the University of West of England? You know, what is the role for polytechnics? And the Labour government got rid of them. As a germ, I think the polytechnics have a very, very important role, and particularly engineering is very, very important. And if you look at German engineered products and compare them to British engineered products, I'll leave it at that.
Okay, thanks. That's a long one.
Do you want me to?
Would you like to take it from going down this way?
Yeah, happy to. I mean, I kind of wondered if you had heard what I had said, because I guess some of the points that I was making was specifically there are different models, and that's, you know, Singapore has been a model for some of the Gulf countries, and also the points I was making about the investment in R&D in India, I think, agree with what you were saying rather than disagreeing. I would say, as an economist and as someone who studied politics, philosophy and economics, I actually think that if you want to produce economists that really are good at applying economic theory to reality, it is useful to have a broader take and to focus on critical thinking, because economic theories are really not actually that useful on their own as a guide to reality and can often be quite misleading. You know, one studies the free market and then, you know, faces real countries. So I would also say, you know, it may be true that the City of London would only take graduates from a certain number of universities, but, you know, that's not the main employer in our country and it's not the single thing that people should aspire to be.
If you want to increase tuition fees to £9,000 per year, all right, you really have to think very hard where you want to study. And if the average salary is £25,000 in the UK, the average house price is £180,000, and you don't go to the City or to GlaxoSmithKline or to BAE, where do you end up?
Okay, I don't think we should. Can we discuss that at lunch, maybe? But
well, basically, you really end up studying what you like. So people should study what they like, should seek what they want, and usually it's their passions, many times, that decide. When I did political science in the early 70s, in the early 70s, you see, you don't believe it, but you have to. Actually, everybody was doing medicine and engineering. So basically, it's the passion should drive. That's number one. Regarding the liberal arts model, it's not like to take it to the extreme. It's in every type of education today. In our part of the world, because that's important, people come out of high school from a type of program that is rote learning. You sit down and you memorize the textbook and you produce it at the exam, literally, as you have memorized it, and you understand not a single word out of it, and you forget it within weeks or days. When I see that critical thinking is important to our part of the world, it is the kind of thinking that allows you to ask questions. It is the kind of thinking that allows you to listen to other points of views and to take and give with these points of views. It's a kind of thinking that allows flexibility in dealing with ideas. It is the kind of thinking that allows you to improve your writing skills. People come out of not only high schools, but also colleges of all fields in the Arab world with very limited writing skills. And the writing they learn is the one that they've learned at home or by their own independent reading because they had the passion to it. So writing, thinking, discussing, taking and giving different points of views is extremely needed in our part of the world and is not a European phenomenon on its own, because Europe itself evolved also in a historical context from a time where ideas were persecuted and people were not allowed to express into an order where people take and give and think and consider. And that's where you problem solve. That's your ability to problem solve and to find shortcuts to major problems. This is, I think, the essence of it, and whether it goes through engineering, whether you go through medicine, you have to have some of that. I look at certain institutions where people go into humanities and then they decide to do medicine and they have biology. And what kind of combination would this give? Now, I look at also a lot of I'll give you so many CEOs, so many banks, so many top leadership are history, philosophy, political science, sociology. Wow, why? What did they learn? And I look at a lot of engineers. I mean, there is a lot of things they learn, but also there are certain limitations. Sometimes some of our best Islamists are engineering. And there is a reason for that. You're separated from the history and development of humanist thought as it evolved, and it evolved for everybody. We had a share in it. You have a share in it. Humanity evolved in a certain way, and I have the right, as much as I utilize this electricity, to utilize the thought that was produced by Hegel and Kant and all of the others into Max Weber, into modernity, into postmodernity. Why not? And then evolve from there and add to it and relate it to my environment. And that's important. Or else we will always be disconnected ourselves in this region from the world. And what I see today in these changes and revolutions is a cry for connectivity, not only on Facebook, but also ideas. There was a question on models, and I agree. There's so many models, and I see the Qatar Foundation model is, it depends here on the agreement. I think the original agreement between Georgetown and Qatar, or Cornell and Qatar, included these issues. While with most of the other private universities in the region, there is no such agreement, and therefore it's a different question. And I see this evolving. And India is an important country. It is an important power, and we have the representative of the first Indian university in Kuwait, Mr. Sliman Numtawa. It's privately owned, and I hope you do a good job.
Thank you. This is probably a lunchtime discussion as well, but I think this education systems call for dialogue now, because neither systems didn't evolve independently. They were very independent. We got Aristotle back through the Arabic-speaking world. And so I think the current sort of dramas that play out in the education systems across the world tell us that we have to discuss more with each other, and it's not, the West has huge amounts to learn. Still, we're nowhere near where things should be. But sorry, I shouldn't intervene.
Sure. No, thank you. On the question of a model, and to try in a sense link it to Hans's comments, my research on this issue doesn't necessarily throw up a perfect model. But there was a sense of frustration by nationals in education and more widely that I picked up on in terms of higher education universities that are too far removed from the national context in terms of language and culture, but also too far removed perhaps in terms of what the medium and longer term economic needs might be. Now, part of that might require critical thinking. Part of that might require greater emphasis on more old-fashioned engineering and science work. It's not a matter of being a prisoner of the economy. To take it to the other extreme, there's an Etisalat University in the UAE where pure company sponsorship is designed purely to provide experts or engineers within just the telecoms field on the basis that that is going to be a dominant sector going forward. That's too far in the other extreme. But there has to be a process of negotiation to meet needs. There has to be a government lead. I suspect, therefore, that public universities with a significant role for the local national provider are key to this, but national universities that embrace, yes, a significant use of English, but also prepared to also embrace a significant shift in teaching methods, but also meaningfully engaging with what the needs are of the economy. So the government takes a lead, but genuinely brings the different elements in this package together. One of the comments I picked up on, and again, it was actually interesting, it was by a Kuwaiti, was that at the state universities here, there is a process that goes on, but he described it as something that meets approximately twice a year and doesn't have meaning in terms of really trying to understand what the needs of employers are. Just a small point. It was John Major's Conservative government that scrapped polytechnics.
Okay. So we've got... Wow, there's a, we have to finish at 10 past, I've just been told. So I'm just going to make my way from the bottom and then round here. Yes, please. Thanks. If you could keep the questions short, maybe I'll try not to intervene.
But. Very short. I think one issue we didn't touch during your discussion was the educators who educate the teachers in the before university. Most of the educators here, they are people who don't make it to the university. They go to teachers' colleges in our part of the world. And I think the other issue, which is the one of the reasons, I think, why we still have the expat sponsorship, is because it's part of the entire economy philosophy that we still have to think of. My question is for Dr. Shafiq and Neil, is this, don't you think in order for us to develop further or move forward, we need a stronger dose of taxation in our, as a policy instrument tool in our lives, and a lower dose of religion in our, as a policy tool in our lives?
Could we move on?
Dr. Abbas Al-Mujran from Kuwait University. As economist, probably when I look at the some of the terms that we used in measuring the efficiency of education, whether we talk about internal efficiency or external efficiency, there are, you know, like globally, probably some agreement on the economic measurements and on also education measurement. But when we look at what we call profit-making organization or non-profit-making organization, I found it very hard to accept like this differentiation, because for me, now when we talk about the profit, we talk about the benefit of educational institution. Now the benefit is hard to measure, and also the cost is hard to measure. Now when you look at the benefit, it's not limited to this generation, but it also goes beyond this generation, and the benefit goes probably beyond your own country, you know, to other countries of the world. If you produce like a little bit of research, you know, which is beneficial to everybody, especially in medicine or other things. And now when you look at the cost, it's also very hard to define. Now when you look at the education cost in a higher education institutions like a university, now when you look at a research, you know, production, the research is at the same time is output and input. So how can you come in measuring the cost in this term? So talking about what is the profit that we mean in education is very hard to be accepted by economists unless it is totally defined in the wider scale.
I've got two. I can take two more, I think. Sorry, there are too many. The gentleman right at the back, he
Thank
was
you.
First, and then.
Hani Al-Muhannab, Projects Development. Thank you, Dr. Ghabra, for everybody. The question is, first of all, I'd like to mention something. I'm in the free market and independent. The governments of GCC, directly and indirectly, they want that change to the better. The students centralized universities are wanted, and billions have been scheduled for such a thing to happen. The question is, I would be very thankful, Dr. Ghabra, to tell us more. What do you prefer? Is the Turkish solution as good as a foundation? Or could it be that establishing that ideal student-centralized universities could be fairly profitable, a profit that is not harsh, which makes the parents work day and night to pay for their children, and which breaks down the social life of the and get advantage out of the university facilities, such as the stadiums, or get into the income from the supported buildings or services the university has, invest on what they have. What do you suggest? How do we get that student-centralized dream come true, university and the GCC? Sorry. By foundation or low profit? And get an advantage of the commercial facilities there. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. The gentleman there who was... I know there's several hands here. I'm afraid we won't be able to take them because we have the closing ceremony, I believe. So.
Thank you. I have a brief question, if you don't mind. For me, the knowledge-based economy should be based on the reach of the information easily and rightfully. The idea behind the knowledge-based economy is not existing in the Arab world. Till now, we have so many problems. We have to talk about transparency. We have to talk about good governance and so on, which we don't have. If we are talking about knowledge-based economy, then we have to do what's so-called the good education. What do you expect from a nation that teaches about 80 working days only out of 365 days?
Okay, thank you.
What do you expect from a nation that produces oil right. according to the need of the world, not the need of the people? One more thing for Dr. Al-Ghabra, if you don't mind. We need somebody to think seriously of us, to respect us, not to create a nation that follows some kind of a curriculum based on or created by somebody. We need somebody to respect us, to give us the chance to think seriously and to gear these curriculums according to our own needs, not to gear us according to these curriculums.
Thank you very
You're
much.
You're talking about one more thing, ma'am. Private education. These private schools, what did they do for us? How many jobs did they create? How much tax did you pay? About the zakat and about the Muslim endowment and so on. You
I'll have to interrupt, I'm afraid.
Social
I'm
welfare
we're
economy.
Totally
thank
out
you.
Of, we're totally out of time. Thank you very much. And I know you were trying to sneak in. No, I'm sorry, I can't. All the speakers will have to have just a couple of minutes each to finish, because maybe we can do this afterwards. Yeah, at lunch. At lunch. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you. We're trying to sneak in a question, but...
No, the lunchtime, I prefer to have it at the table.
Okay, so should we just let you round up for one or two minutes each, and that's... finish it.
Well, I'll be very brief. I thought those were all relevant and interesting comments, and I think we have so I basically agree and don't need to say too much, but there has been quite a clear theme emerging of the need for teaching and research that is directly relevant to the local region. That's something that probably can also apply to scientific research as well as the politics and the economy and so on that we discussed. I know it's been quite a theme in the discussion of the development of kind of biotechnology and pharmaceuticals and things, that there needs to be things that cater to local realities. I look forward to discussing with you more over lunch. Thank you.
Well, so many questions. I mean, our last speaker is—he always comes to me, and we've had this dialogue on and on. What did private schools do? I'll tell you. I have Farah Naqib here. She's a product of a private school, American School of Kuwait. I have my daughter over there, Hanin. She's a product of a private. Farah has a PhD from London. Hanin has a BA and MA from the US. She's working with the Prime Minister's office. Farah is working at the American University of Kuwait. And I see several faces. I mean, private schools have done, and you also, and Saif here has done an amazing job, and now at the Prime Minister's office. What they do a lot, because they've been oriented in a certain type of education. It may have limitations. It can evolve, but it is important. And in the end, it's freedom of parents to choose. I choose to put my children in private schools. You choose to put them in a public school. You want a certain type of education? Sahtain. Do that, and the end result, you bear your end result. I bear my end result. Each one is looking for. So private and free market is important, and freedom is important. Now, there is all this talk about, I mean, respect, yes. What is the curriculum at all the private institutions or universities? It is a curriculum that respects. You're bringing this. You're sending thousands of... I mean, Saudi Arabia has several thousand students studying in the USA. There are several thousand Kuwaitis studying in the USA and UK and France and elsewhere. Why not in Kuwait? Why not in Saudi Arabia? Why not in the Arab world? This is respect, actually, when you do it and you bring in this curriculum and try to master it. Now, if you are of a critical mind, you will read this curriculum and you will be able to say, well, I disagree with this. I like this. I want to do more research. Today, we are based on research. We are based on trying to discover your own findings and learning. So keep this open. Don't complicate it. Now, there was important questions on profit and non-profit. And what I mean, please, it's important. What I mean by non-profit is an institution that nobody pockets the money at the end of the day. It goes back to the institution. For profit, there is a surplus that doesn't go to the institution and it goes to investors. That's what I mean by for-profit. And here there are issues that we need to evaluate. And how do you value it? I don't know. Sometimes it is too exaggerated, the profit, that the institution suffers. And I see a lot of suffering by institutions as a result of big return requested by the investors. I would end it here. Thank you.
Just like to respond to a couple of points the gentleman in the front made, which were addressed to me. Clearly, there is a difficulty in my view, shifting from the rentier features of the Labour sponsorship scheme, as I was suggesting, to possibly taxing individuals on their income. That would be dramatic. Perhaps I am, in a sense, trying to urge cautious change of the kind that gives up some of the privileges of the rentier system, which some of the poorer Gulf states are starting to explore, I believe, by questioning the sponsorship system and reducing its dominance. And maybe that's the way forward, because obviously that has a way of reforming the labour market and possibly making nationals more attractive, depending upon how you apply it. Of course, data is crucial to this, as I said earlier. you need the data to be able to target appropriate taxation of foreign labour as well. So the two are linked at that level. On teacher training, absolutely. I mentioned the idea of a National Education Council because it seems to me there needs to be a dramatic reform which would include the training of teachers as well. The difficulty is, of course, you're caught in a cycle because the extent to which there's reliance on outside instructors who may indeed be culturally sympathetic because they're Arab but are not actually national is a difficult impasse to break. But I think it needs to be broken because it's about role models in schools and universities, and I think that's central to the whole reform process.
Thank you very much. That was a very enlightening session, and we look forward to discussing this at lunch.